Welcome to Not Your Boyfriend's Sports Show. I'm Bryn.
And I'm Maeve. And this week on the show, the NHL and NBA both have new champions. Plus, we bring you an update on the Women's World Cup from our correspondent on the ground in Canada. Our feature this week, the structures that shape sports. From the deals that determine league-wide policies to the ones that build stadiums, we look at what else is at play in sports. Then, it's the return of Fierce Ladies! So, Bryn, start us off. The NBA, who won the championship?
All right, so the Golden State Warriors are the NBA champions. And while many people had thought that this final series would go really quickly because the Cavaliers didn't stand much of a chance, LeBron James had other ideas about this. Yeah. And the Cavs ended up taking the Warriors to 6 games before the NBA MVP Steph Curry's team prevailed. A few things to note about this series. The series MVP was Andre Iguodala, who didn't start a single game in the regular season, but came up huge for the Warriors in the final. And his primary responsibility was guarding LeBron James throughout the entire series. So he had a lot on his hands. But interestingly, while Iguodala won the MVP for guarding LeBron James, LeBron set all kinds of records throughout the series, leading both teams in all the categories, in points, assists, and rebounds. So it's pretty remarkable that the Cavs were even in the finals, given all the injuries that they had throughout the season. And LeBron was pretty spectacular throughout the tournament. But in the end, Steph Curry and the Warriors took home the championship. And I'm happy because now we don't have to flip back and forth between the NBA and the Women's World Cup.
True.
So,
the NHL also wrapped up their championship series. The Chicago Blackhawks beat the Tampa Bay Lightning in Game 6 to win the Stanley Cup for the third time in 6 years. They had previously won in 2010, breaking a 49-year championship drought. Wow. And they had won again in 2013. This year was sort of a bittersweet victory, as the Blackhawks' longtime equipment manager, Clint Reif, committed suicide earlier in the season. Mm-hmm. And another ex-Blackhawks player, Steve Montador, also died this year. On a kind of sadder note, he was convinced that he had chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
CTE,
we'll call it. Which is a neurodegenerative brain disorder linked to repeated concussions.
Oh, wow.
And so he had arranged to have an autopsy performed on his brain after his death. And indeed, he did have CTE. The NFL offered their condolences, but they then denied a link between his death and his NHL career. So
the concussion debate goes on.
Yeah. So tough season for the Blackhawks, but ultimately they come out on top, and congratulations to them.
Right. Okay, so now we're turning over to the Women's World Cup coverage, and we are super lucky to have a correspondent in the field. Sasha Frankel has made the trek to Canada for Not Your Boyfriend Sports Show. And Sasha, what has the atmosphere been like?
It's been so awesome in Canada. We started in Vancouver and saw the U.S. They beat Nigeria 1-0. It was Abby Wambach scored her first goal of the World Cup, and it was actually really exciting. And the atmosphere in Vancouver was insane. It's so close to the Pacific Northwest of the U.S. Like a lot of Americans, big soccer fans
up there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was huge. And you could see people on the streets everywhere. It was like really exciting. There were parties. And then after that game, we made our way east and we arrived in Edmonton. And it's been a little bit of a different atmosphere here. So we saw the China-Cameroon game, and that was actually a really fun game to watch.
Who won that one?
So China won, okay. And they kind of dominated. Cameroon had looked really good previously against Switzerland, but they were having some trouble against China's like really, really tight passes.
And that's who the U.S. faces next, correct?
Yeah, exactly. So it's going to be interesting. This is on Friday. So they'll play in Ottawa against China. Okay. And China's looking really dangerous. It's going to be a tough game for the U.S.
And then you were at the U.S. game against Colombia on Monday night.
Yes. So we got tickets to the knockout round, and we got really lucky because the U.S. made it, and we got to see them up close and personal. And that was also really fun. The U.S. fan base was actually kind of weak. There wasn't a huge turnout either. There were about 19,000 people in a stadium that can fit about 50,000 people. You know, we came off with a win, but we're not looking that strong. The defense is really great, but we need to get it together, I think, in the midfield and definitely up top. We haven't really been finishing.
Yeah, and that's interesting because our defense is a pretty young group. Like, they're pretty inexperienced on the international stage. So for them to be standing up is great to see, but now our offense needs to step it up as well.
Yeah, honestly, I think they need a little bit of new blood up top. Yeah, definitely getting
people have been saying.
Yeah.
They're going to have to play so much better against China if they're going to keep going.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so now we're in the round of 8 coming up beginning next week.
Yeah, starting on Friday.
So of the teams that you've seen play, who looks the strongest to you?
Japan looks really, really good. Germany also is just, they're like a machine, honestly. They're looking super dangerous. And the quarterfinal Germany-France game is going to be one to watch for
sure. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the front runners, I think, are projected to be Germany, the U.S., and then France. But from what I've seen, France looks like they're playing way better than the U.S.
France is looking really good. You know, of course, I'm rooting for the U.S., but we're going to have to step it up. We'll see.
All right. Well, thank you, Sasha, for your firsthand insight. It's interesting to see that we're seeing the same things on TV and in person. So this was great. Thanks so much.
I'm so glad to be on the show. I'm a big fan.
Thanks, Sash. All right. So we're going to take a little bit of a breather. And when we come back, we'll be giving you a primer on some of the structures that underlie all the sports you watch.
Welcome back. So this week's feature, we are talking about the structures behind sports. So every week you tune in, you watch your favorite player, you watch your favorite team, that's all great. But behind the scenes, there are a lot of systems and deals and rules and regulations that are actually determining who you see playing every week and what they're getting paid to play and where they're playing. So this week we're going to talk a little bit about those kinds of structures. And let's start off with collective bargaining agreements.
All right. So collective bargaining agreements they're basically agreements that are reached between league players and owners that dictate how the league's going to operate, including division of revenue, salary caps, free agency requirements, restrictions on trades, like draft rules, and other disciplinary rules throughout the season. So they govern everyone who's involved with the leagues, whether it's players, agents, owners, officials, basically everyone. For example, when the NBA's collective bargaining agreements were renegotiated in 2011, the team owners got a really good deal as they negotiated that the basketball-related income for the league that was divided between the owners and the players, essentially, was increased from 43% to 50% for going to the owners.
So that's a big chunk of change.
It's a big chunk of change, and it's sort of an example of how when these things are renegotiated, sometimes the owners win out, sometimes the players win out. There's already talk about when the NBA renegotiates in 2017 that the players are saying they'll be willing to get into a lockout situation, mm-hmm. basically a strike where they hold out until they get what they want, rather than giving into as many concessions as they did in 2011. So it's one of those things that kind of sways back and forth on based on who has power, based on the overall environment. But there's so many components that go in there that some concessions are going to be made no matter what. But what gets pretty interesting in talking about collective bargaining agreements is talking about college sports. Where college student athletes don't have this kind of ability to negotiate right. for themselves. The NCAA is so staunch in calling them amateurs and not allowing them to be employees. So they don't have the same kind of power to say what they need, whether it's healthcare or it's more food, as we saw with Shabazz Napier. And yet the NCAA, you know, sells their jerseys and puts them in video games. So,
but there was recently at Northwestern.
Yeah, exactly. Northwestern football this year, after the season, petitioned to be able to unionize, which in effect changes them from student athletes to employees. Yeah. So they gained the ability to argue for some of these things, and just the designation of employees opens it up for people in the future to come in and demand not just like modest things that the Northwestern football players wanted, but broader things. And it's eventually going to get into paying college players as professionals.
Though, as I understand it, it's still pretty limited because it only includes Northwestern's obviously been allowed to unionize,
right,
and other teams in their particular conference may be able to, but it doesn't extend to the full scope of NCAA teams.
Right. And the thing with college football players is that college programs are on such different levels, whether it's a MAC team against a Big Ten team. They can't have the same, like a collective bargaining agreement that covers all of the NCAA would be impossible just based on the size of the programs and the difference in power dynamics that they have. So yeah, Northwestern won the right to unionize, but they're not even sure if they're going to exercise that right after this year. And the football coach has asked them not to.
Wow. So. Democracy in action.
Yeah. We'll see how that goes.
One thing that is definitely determined by collective bargaining agreements in the pros is draft eligibility. So draft eligibility is pretty straightforward. It's who is eligible to be drafted. And it's a really straightforward example of how the structures that regulate various sports shape them in different ways. So for example, let's start simple. In the NHL, to be drafted, you just have to be 19 years old, and that's it. And this simplicity reflects two major characteristics. First of all, 1/3 of NHL players are international, so it's harder to require college participation or reliance on a farm league system.
Yeah.
And a farm league is like a minor league system. So it's a professional league, but it's not at the same level.
Top-tier level.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like training ground for people who want to get to the pros. And secondly, the NHL has a relatively player-friendly collective bargaining agreement.
Mm-hmm.
So as Bryn was saying, they have, you know, it's more favorable to the players rather than the NBA, where it's right now more favorable to the coaches.
Yeah.
But an interesting little counterexample is actually the new Women's Hockey League. They just had their first ever draft this month.
Congrats.
Yeah. And to be eligible for that, you had to have completed at least your junior season at college. And this actually reflects some interesting differences between men and women's sports in general. So for the women, to have finished at least your junior year at four-year college, you have to be probably, what, like 20 or 21 years old. You have to have gone to college.
Yeah.
So it sets up a different power structure to begin with for men versus women, and when they can start profiting off of their talents.
Mm-hmm.
So if we move on to soccer, what's interesting about the MLS is that while soccer is definitely, you know, the world's sport, the MLS is definitely not the premier league.
Yeah.
So the draft is really U.S.-centric. NCAA college seniors are eligible. They also have a kind of minor league quasi-system called Generation Adidas.
Okay.
Which really just is what, like another sponsorship opportunity? But basically, these are players who have left college early to focus on soccer.
Gotcha.
And the other interesting part of this is that players can only be accepted from NCAA colleges, so not Canadian colleges, even though there are Canadian teams in the MLS.
So what do international players do to get into the MLS?
I think they can be part of this Generation Adidas thing, because those can also be players who've been nominated by a team.
Got it.
So there are all these sort of loopholes, even though it stays really U.S.-centric. And women's soccer also had to start from scratch back in 2013, but given the prominence of the women's national team and that there have been prior attempts at a professional league, there's a little more precedent than with the women's hockey league. So there are really two main categories allocated players who are determined by the national federations. So this is the USA, Canada, and Mexico. And their salaries are also paid by the federation, so they don't count towards salary caps. And this is basically to give the teams a chance to attract players who aren't on the national team.
Which has been a problem in the past.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's good.
Definitely. And then also college seniors can be recruited. Okay, so next, if you move to the MLB, Major League Baseball, this has perhaps the most established and transparent system. The MLB has a really good farm league, and so players can either try to go to the farm league out of high school, or they can go to college for a minimum of 3 years. This takes a lot of the burden off of the college system. That's why NCAA baseball isn't, you know, as corrupt as football or basketball or whatever else. So basically, these are kids who either have graduated high school and then determine that they want to go straight for the draft, or they've gone to junior college, or they've played in a farm league, or they've played in college. So lots of different options. You can really sort of like pick your path for whatever is best for your situation. Then now we start getting into the really murky territory with the NFL, because the NFL technically requires players to be 3 years out of high school and to have used up their college eligibility.
Which runs so counter to what we see every year in the draft.
Right. So college eligibility means that you're eligible to play college football for 4 years. But underclassmen or players who graduate before their eligibility is up can request to be entered into the draft, which is where it gets really shady, because now players are operating in this sort of behind-the-scenes system with their agents and deals and trades and talks. And it happens so frequently, like, it's not really an exception. Like, in 2015, there were 84 players who used this exception.
I mean, have you ever heard of someone wanting to enter the draft and being denied?
Right, exactly.
I don't think so.
So it's sort of a sham. And further, there's no farm system for the NFL, really. So it forces players into college and then either try to play their 4 years of college or have to, you know, run shenanigans behind the scene to get declared for the draft early. Finally, the NBA is the clearest example of how draft rules can really shape the game.
Yeah.
The NBA has a barely there farm league, so they mostly rely on college. Players have to be 19 during the calendar year of the draft, and they have to be a year out of high school. So this leads to one-and-done players who go to college for a year and then they declare for the draft. And it completely changes the college game.
And that rule was pretty recently enacted. I think it was maybe 2012 that it was said that players had to go to at least 1 year of college.
Yeah.
So before that, people would go straight from high school, and it was completely different.
Right, like LeBron went straight from high school.
Right.
Yeah.
And now you see Calipari, who at Kentucky sends multiple people to the NBA every single season.
Right. And he just makes these teams made up of these superstars.
Yeah.
So anyway, the NBA is this really clear example where it's a very like quid pro quo between the college system and the pros.
Yeah.
And then the last counterexample of the women's leagues is the WNBA, and players have to be 22. They have to have completed their college eligibility or to have graduated or be 4 years removed from high school. So this is actually a pretty divisive rule, because supporters say it encourages players to complete their college education and have better prospects besides the WNBA, where they'll likely make less money. But on the other hand, critics say that it robs potential players of some of their most productive and profitable years, and it makes them more prone to injury. And it just is unequal compared to the men's system, where they can become hugely profitable really early.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And it was kind of the same thing with hockey, too, is that the women had to wait a lot longer.
Right. And we'll see what happens with the Women's Hockey League, because it's so fledgling right now.
Yeah.
And obviously the NHL is way more established. But yeah, draft eligibility, it totally shapes the pool of players who are available to you, which then directly shapes the league, how well your team does, how much money the owners make. And I guess we could go right back to collective bargaining agreements and who has more power there.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, that is a really good primer on the draft and how these players come into the leagues. Let's switch over to another topic, which is something that gets talked a lot about in sports, mostly in European soccer, but it's recently been coming up when we're talking about the NBA draft. Mm-hmm. And that topic is relegation.
What is relegation? Well, for the listeners out there,
I am going to tell you because it's one of those things that will give you some instant credibility if you're able to discuss it. And it's a lot of fun to play a game of what if when you apply the idea of relegation to some of the biggest sports in the U.S. So the easiest way to explain the concepts of relegation and promotion is to look at soccer's Premier League in the U.K., which is the best league in English football or soccer. So below the Premier League, there's a league called the Championship League. So it goes Championship and then Premier League is the best of the best. And what happens each year is that the bottom three teams from the Premier League are relegated mm-hmm. or moved down to play in the Championship League the next year.
Ooh.
So they get replaced by the top two teams in the Championship League who get promoted into the Premier League, plus the winner of a playoff between the third through sixth place teams in the Championship. But what makes this work is that the Championship League, the second tier, is a pretty robust and heavily followed league in its own right. So it's not as good as the Premier League, but there's good competition there.
Right.
Teams are able to stay together and compete well throughout the year. So it's a pretty simple concept. You're the worst in the Premier League, you move down. You're the best in the Championship League, you move up the next
right.
year. But it really, you know, it does wonders in giving the teams who aren't going to win the Premier League title, it gives them something to play for throughout the year.
Right.
So they're constantly striving to make sure they're not the bottom three teams. And another thing to consider is that the Premier League doesn't really share revenue with the lower leagues. So any team that's relegated from the Premier League is losing a ton of money that they would have been making off of the Premiership's TV contract.
They
get none of that money if they're relegated.
Wow.
So it kind of starts this vicious cycle where the teams that got relegated down to the Championship League are at a real financial disadvantage when they're looking to pick up new players, or lots of times they have to fire a ton of staff when they are relegated.
But then it makes
it harder for them to climb back up and out of the Championship League.
But shouldn't it also put them at some sort of an advantage in the Championships League because they're theoretically a better team if they keep their players, which maybe they don't.
Right.
Because of trades or whatever, their
players can get poached by Premiership
right.
teams.
Hmm.
So it's pretty interesting to look at. And then there's also something called the sophomore slump, where teams that move up into the Premier League from the Championship League do really well their first year and then end up a lot of times getting relegated their second year. So it's kind of fun to look at. It makes everything more competitive because not only are you following the top teams, you're also following the bottom teams.
And this is kind of related to the NBA draft system.
Exactly.
And I guess a lot of draft systems, because if you're the worst team, you usually get the first pick of the draft.
Right. So it's really fun to apply this concept to other sports, especially the big ones in the U.S., because right now in the NBA, we're seeing a lot of teams, if they know that they aren't going to make the playoffs, they'll start tanking really early and try to lose as many games as possible to get the best draft picks for the next year. So 538, who we talk about all the time, they did this massive crowdsourcing of how to fix the NBA draft lottery. And one of the ideas that came up over and over again was applying relegation.
Mm-hmm.
So these tanking teams would get relegated to the system you talked about earlier, the farm system, or they call it the D-League, the Development League.
Which, well, continue, and then we can discuss why maybe this isn't realistic.
I mean, the problem is that the Development League is so astronomically below the NBA that to move a team down there would be like taking a college team and having them play against middle schoolers.
Right.
Like, it would be a disaster, and the players would revolt. But it's really, I mean, there should be some kind of modified way to make this work in the NBA, or some way to incentivize teams to not tank at the end of this season, because it gets really sad.
Well, podcast shout out. There is an episode of 538's Hot Takedown where they, I think they took like their three favorite user-generated new models and they discussed whether those ideas were realistic or not.
And they get into the nitty-gritty.
Yeah. So anyway, it's a good listen.
Listen to this primer, and then you might be ready to go listen to all of that.
Right.
But as Maeve talked about the farm leagues before, what it would take to make relegation work for U.S. sports is just a total overhaul of these development leagues and making them so much stronger. Hopefully getting some kind of a following for development leagues so that when a team gets relegated there, it's not the end of the world.
Well, so right now the only league with a really strong farm league is the MLB.
Yeah.
But the farm leagues are really, they're really meant to bring players into the Major League Baseball team that owns and operates that farm league team.
Right.
So it's a little bit different.
It wouldn't really work.
Still an interesting idea.
Yeah, something to think about. I mean, even in the NFL, like, let's relegate the Jaguars. They were terrible this year. Let's, like, relegate some of these people to, I don't know, a Canadian league or, like, arena football.
Well, I mean, something else that you would have to consider in the relegation model is that the different major leagues in the U.S., split up their money so differently. Like in the NFL, every team gets the same amount of money to work with.
Right.
In the MLB, the Yankees and the Red Sox have more money than they probably know what to do with.
Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, the whole Moneyball thing started because the Oakland A's had like no money and they needed to try to do something that would make them a little better. So,
yeah, the ownership structure, the development league structure, all of that would have to completely change if relegation was going to work here.
Right. So this is why, as you set this up at the beginning, it's a good sort of what-if game to play.
Yeah.
How realistic this is that these are that this might be the solution to any of the power trading problems.
And it depends on who you're talking to, whether you can continue to modify it.
Right.
Get deeper and deeper until it finally might work.
But anyway, let's snap back to reality. And we've talked a lot about the rules and regulations and those kinds of structures, but there are also very physical structures that determine where teams play and who pays for them to play there. So there are lots of reasons to really love your local sports team besides money. There's
what? Really?
There's pride, team history. There are heroes you can look up to, a distraction from, you know, the daily drum of life. And it's a ready conversation starter wherever you go, much like we've discovered with this podcast. But many people also add local jobs and revenue for the city to that list of why sports teams are good for communities. But for a really long time, sports economists, which sounds like a great job, sports economists have been trying to tell us why building stadiums and maintaining teams is actually a really bad public investment. So the basic deal goes something like this. Team owners demand public funds, whether through direct cash, tax breaks, land donations, whatever, to build and maintain stadiums while these team owners retain private ownership. If city officials balk, then they threaten to relocate the franchise. Politicians sell it as a job creator and a really good revenue stream. But basically, pick any stadium in the country, and this is the general gist that this terrible deal has happened. Recent examples include the hockey team, the Phoenix Coyotes in Glendale, Arizona, PNC Park in Pittsburgh, where the Pirates play. That's some alliteration for you.
Pirates, Pittsburgh.
And even right here in D.C. with the recently approved D.C. United Stadium.
Yeah, it's been a mess.
Yeah, so these are all really good examples of how public funds get used to build private stadiums. So let's address these claims one by one. First of all, job creating. Most of the jobs created by stadiums are either temporary, they're low paying, or they're out-of-state contracting jobs. And these jobs are only around for as long as the season before the stadiums then sit mostly empty. And athletes, who are the most prominent employees, rarely pay taxes in the states in which they play, so they assume residence somewhere else where there are much more friendly income tax policies. So the second argument was, you know, it's this great revenue stream. But the reality is that besides the few blocks surrounding the stadium where the bars are, it's not really that profitable for the city. Stadiums and sports teams mostly generate local money, so this means local people going to the local team's game rather than out-of-towners coming in and staying at your hotels and eating at your restaurants and, you know, taking taxis everywhere. So if local people didn't spend their dollars on sports, they would spend it on bowling or the movies or whatever else they like to do for fun.
Yeah.
Another major problem is that stadiums are typically built with long-term bonds, so this leaves cities holding on to debt that can often last for 30 years or more. Public workers, on the other hand, are usually on much shorter contracts, so even sometimes just a year-long contract. So when budget cuts are necessary, it's then a lot easier to cut public employees than to cut funding for stadiums. Right. And finally, economists have been perhaps vastly underestimating the true cost of these projects because they don't consider public subsidies, ongoing costs of operations, capital improvements. So, you know, when you need a new scoreboard or something, municipal services, you need a lot of traffic cops.
Yeah.
And definitely lost property taxes, because every major league franchise does not pay property taxes due to some questionable loopholes.
Interesting.
So Judith Grant Long is a professor of urban planning at Harvard, and she estimates that the average public cost for a new stadium is $241 million, and this is up from $142 million in the 90s.
That's so much money.
So yeah, these contracts, these deals are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's estimated that Americans have spent $31 billion with a B subsidizing these privately owned stadiums.
Wow.
For example, just 3 of the 31 NFL stadiums were built without public funds, and 2 of those 3 later took public funds for upgrades. And let's just remember that the NFL is the richest and most profitable league in the U.S. And look, I really don't fault cities for wanting local sports teams and wanting them to stay. I really love supporting my teams, and I really do think that sports bring people together and are good for communities. But what is questionable here is 2 things. First of all, that these millionaire, billionaire owners demand public funds to build stadiums, but also demand that they retain private ownership of them and avoid paying all sorts of taxes.
Right.
And secondly, the political and legal system that's been really diluted to the point where franchises have all of the leverage in these negotiations.
And just watching the D.C. debate over the D.C. United Stadium unfold, yeah, it's been really interesting, because at one point they were threatening to move the stadium to Virginia. I'm sure that was just like a ploy to get more public funds or to get it all cleared faster. Yeah. It's pretty amazing how little power the city has and how much manipulation can go on.
Totally. And what ended up happening in D.C. is this deal where D.C. acquires the land that the stadium will be built on. I think it's like $89 million or something. And then they pay an additional, I think it's $45 million to clear the land, provide some of the infrastructure, get it ready. And then D.C. United and the MLS will then build the actual stadium.
Yeah. So and that's a ton of public funds before the stadium's even built.
Right. And, you know, in the meantime, we could use more public school teachers and you know, other things. And not to say that I'm, you know, not excited for a new stadium, but it's just like you just have to consider where your tax dollars are going. And sometimes it's really hidden because you even get confused with how much you want to root for your own team.
Yeah.
Yeah. So lots of different structures that are determining where people play, how much they get paid to play, what power they have in representing themselves for playing.
Yep.
And hopefully it's been some food for thought.
Definitely. Well, when we come back, we are going to talk about someone who is determining her own destiny and the only person, or the only thing she's really fighting against is weather at this point. So we will introduce you to our next fierce lady after this break.
All right, and welcome back. It is a return to our favorite segment, Fierce Ladies.
Fierce Ladies.
So, Bryn, who is this week's Fierce Lady?
This week's Fierce Lady is Sarah Outen, who is a 29-year-old from the UK, and she is attempting to circumnavigate the globe just on her own human power. So that means biking, kayaking, walking, rowing. It's all manual. There's,
No engines.
No engines involved. The journey is 26,000 miles total, and she's home stretching it. She has just over 3,000 miles to go.
Just
3,000 miles, crossing the Atlantic as we speak. So it's pretty fascinating. She is incredibly strong and in shape, as you can imagine.
Mentally, I'd imagine, as well as physically.
Right. She's totally isolated. She isn't traveling with a pit crew. You know, she's like met up with some people who are dropping off supplies along the way, but it's just her. She says she talks to the fish sometimes.
I feel like this is people who hike the Appalachian Mountains or the Woman in Wild, but on steroids.
Yeah, like times a million. It's crazy. So this article I was reading about her is pretty funny because it was saying that she started this journey in 2011.
Oh my God.
And she is 2 years behind schedule right now. So it's like, just lost a little bit of time, 2 years worth.
I didn't have any plans for those 2 years though, so it's okay.
Well, she has a fiance at home, so I don't know how she's managing this.
Wow.
But anyways, Sarah Outen, she at one point had to be rescued by the Japanese Coast Guard because she was stuck in really horrendous weather for 3 days, and her boat ended up being so damaged that they couldn't save it.
Wow.
And she had to go back to the UK and get another boat to pick up where she left off.
Do you know who's sponsoring her?
She has a lot of sponsors. You can actually follow her progress live on her website at sarahouten.com, sarahouten.com. And it has information of all of her sponsors. You can see a GPS locator of where she is right now.
Cool.
She does these phone updates, little mini podcasts where she talks about how it's been going. So you can see all of that there.
Wow.
And it is pretty crazy. She is definitely a fierce lady.
The fiercest of ladies.
Yeah.
Well,
I would argue that.
Good luck to Sarah in the remainder of her journey.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to be following.
I hope she writes a book. All right. Well, I think that does it for this week's episode.
Sure does.
You can find us.
Well, we should note that we are going to be taking a short hiatus.
Right.
From the pod.
We're taking a little summer break.
Little summer break. And we will resume in August.
Right.
As a long distance podcast. But we'll update all of our social media with updates about that. And for now, you can find us.
You can find us on Facebook at Not Your Boyfriend's Sports Show, on Twitter at NYBF Sports, on Instagram at NYBF Sports, and you can email us at nybfsports@gmail.com.
And our pod will be up on iTunes and Stitcher.
Yes.
So check us out.
And we promise to let everybody know when we're gonna get back on the pod.
We'll be back before you know it.
All right, so have a happy summer vacation, Bryn.
Thanks.
And good game.
Good game, babe.